Hi, and welcome to another edition of Stormy Weather, news from the front line in the end times. This is your host, Aeolus Caithless, and I'll be talking once again with Kerry McCoy. This is, we're just picking up where we left off last week. Doesn't matter if you didn't catch last week's show, but it may seem a little abrupt. We're just moving right into a discussion on the convoluted nature of politics.
A lot of it has, I think, to do with how convoluted just the government and bureaucracy, the system is today. Everything's entirely convoluted. It's hard to do anything, break out of a box, or do anything creative. You're so tied down with everything.
Sure. Yeah, because we've lost our sense of purpose, our divine purpose in life, it's left a great void. And rather than waiting and allowing that void to be until that divine purpose comes back to us, we've tried to fill it with all these arbitrary ideas about progress, change, evolution, democracy, you know, the human God. And religion, of course, is the biggest culprit, because then our purpose is to, you know, be pious and go to heaven, and that's it, you know, just die and go to heaven and play your harp for all eternity. I mean, what kind of purpose is that? I don't know. It's a very infantile one, but it's been, that's along with politics, which is a more mundane kind of brainwash, and these arbitrary goals and purposes, these are working away, and it's sort of, again, it's sort of vicious circle, because that political religious system is only able to come into being because we lack individual purpose. I've kind of lost my thread now. It's so convoluted, I can't even think about it.
Yeah, it is, and it's hard to keep a consistent line of thought when you're talking about this topic, because it is so all-encompassing that it's so easy to get off on tangents and then forget what you were talking about originally. Everything affects each other, you know.
Yeah, well, I was trying to get to you know, because the political conspiracy is always a relevant topic for our listeners, and yet I'm always looking for a different angle on that.
Well, let's talk about this lack of sense of purpose. Okay, so it seems that we're suffering from this mass sense of purpose, and along comes the Green Revolution, and now all of a sudden everybody's got a renewed sense of purpose, and that sense of purpose is to save the Earth from man-made global warming, right? I mean, everybody knows, everybody's been told, I know I've heard it about a million times through the various media sources, that global warming is in fact real, and it's man-made, and you know, it's to the point now where if you disagree, then you're a kook.
Mm-hmm.
You've become a kook. You're now with the UFO nuts and the Holocaust deniers if you don't believe that global warming is in fact real and serious and you need to do something about it.
Well, isn't George W. Bush one of these deniers, though, also? Doesn't he deny global warming?
I'm not exactly sure what his stance is at the time, but that's kind of irrelevant, because everybody already knows that even if George Bush did actually believe in global warming, his economic interest and his oil buddies, you know, they come first. So that's not even really relevant.
Well, it's relevant in a sense, because it's sort of an example of how deep the mind fuck goes and the mind control goes. Because if George Bush, as you point out, if George Bush is denying global warming, nobody's going to believe him anyway, except the people who are too dumb to, you know, even know that George Bush is an idiot, kind of thing.
Well, it's very polarizing here in the States also.
That's exactly what I mean. I was going to get to that. It's a way of polarizing consciousness, because
absolutely,
people are not going to believe George Bush because he's going to say that anyway. But the thing is that if global warming is a hoax, and a man-made global warming rather, and apparently it is, then George Bush would know that. So he would be simply stating what he knows.
Right. Well, it's a very big mind fuck, and it's incredibly polarizing because the type of person who already believes that George Bush is a huge liar is over on the left and is going to be considered a liberal. And you can't be a liberal and not believe in global warming. And on
Right.
the conservative side, if you're a conservative, well, then the global warming is probably bullshit.
Right. So there you
But
go. I
what they
mean,
do is it's kind of like a mix of disinformation. That's how different disinformation works. It's not an outright liar and outright truth. It's a mixture of lies and truth spread around for everybody to try to sort out.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing because I mean, the polarization is not just among the liberals and the conservatives and, these different factions, environmentalists and the globalists, what have you. It's a polarization that's occurring actually within the consciousness of the individual because what we've been giving this very conflicting information, and at a subconscious level, of course, we know everything. We're not. With a subconscious level, we don't have to rationally study and interpret information. We simply know our bodies know stuff, just as the animals know. So we know that global warming is a result of sunflower activity, let's say. Of course, I don't know that for sure because I'm just processing information, but let's say that that's the truth. Then we're going to know that at a body level. And yet our minds are telling us something else. So there's this, and the same thing, I've observed this again and again with the Masonic Sorcery Theater, that the way that it operates is that it will create an event that's undeniable, such as these global catastrophes, Hurricane Katrina, for example, and then it will give an explanation which is false. And
Right.
so, and the, but the event is so major that we're all affected by it, and so we're all thinking about it, and we're all grateful for the explanation, or at least we're curious about it. And yet our bodies know, our unconscious minds know that the explanation doesn't fit with the experience that we've had at a bodily level. And so this creates a split. This increases the split between mind and body, or between the conscious and the unconscious mind. And this split is increased when, through the propaganda and the media sort of sorcery method, where when the explanations become less and less probable, more and more implausible, and even to the point of being absurd, and yet we're spoon-fed these things. And so our conscious mind is having to shut down more and more, and become less and less in tune with our unconscious knowing, simply in order to believe these absurd scenarios that we're being given. And so we're getting more and more cut off from the unconscious source of knowledge.
Right. Well, I have a great example that falls right in line with that. In the States here, we've been told that there were all these terrorist cells, and that they're these suicide terrorist cells bent on destroying America. And yet, since 9/11 happened, we haven't had one terrorist attack on American soil. Yet at the same time, we have an open border with Mexico that everybody's grumbling and complaining about. And we have drug cartels who move massive amounts of drugs and weapons and slaves or whatever, for the sex industry back and forth across the border. Yet the terrorists can't take advantage of this. These are the same terrorists who masterminded 9/11 and hijacked jumbo jet, commercial jetliners, and took them over and stunt flight them into buildings with nothing more than box cutters. But you're telling me they can't find a way to slip over the border and get into America and pull off some real, European-style terrorist attacks, like happened in Russia. I believe it was like the Chechen terrorists whenever they took over the schools in Russia. We haven't seen any of that. We've had a couple of school shootings in America, but that was just disgruntled college kids. So to me, that creates real big inconsistency with the official line. I just can't understand how all these terrorists could be after us, and we could have a open border, be completely vulnerable, and yet nothing's happening.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's what you're talking about, right? It's just it's the erosion of common sense and instinct over, and what wins out is the official line.
Yeah, and now, I mean, the biggest mystery is always to me how it's not being questioned, how these most glaring inconsistencies or obvious bald-faced lies are not being questioned in the media. And it becomes harder and harder to talk about and then eventually even think about these things because of the emotional pressure that we're under, I think, is a key as well.
True. And I would, I'm 99% of the people would say that I'm a lunatic just for suggesting what I just did, just for following my common sense, just saying, how is that possible?
Mm-hmm.
You don't even ask a question like that. You don't use deductive reasoning, critical thinking. You just repeat.
Well,
otherwise, otherwise you'll be an outcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, you're a terrorist sympathizer just by questioning the government's policy anyway. Nobody wants to think about terrorism or terrorist acts, not really, not in terms of, like, personally, like how it might affect them personally. They don't mind thinking about them in a sort of wider framework. But and of course, people don't want to think about the possibility that their government is the biggest terrorist of them all. So, I mean, these are... people are going to do it.
When you say their government, you see, I think that's a big problem, is that a lot of people use too many generalized terms. They want to say it's the government or the CIA. They want to talk about, they will always have to name like an official group. And the problem is, I think that the people who are really pulling off a lot of this stuff, they don't really have names, and they operate within groups.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what they do. They kind of put a mask on. They integrate into a group, and they
sure.
use the resources of the group to carry out their agenda. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's the government. It's not the CIA or the FBI.
It is to these people that we're talking about, to your average person who doesn't want to think about the inconsistencies and the glaring discrepancies in government policy and the party line and all of this. To them, there is the government, the CIA, and the terrorists. No?
Well, right. That's why I'm saying that. To me, that's a big part of the problem when it comes to thinking about this, and reasoning it out. There's too much generalized typecasting.
Well, there is, and it's, I mean, this is true also, as I'm sure you were also pointing out, when it comes to conspiracy researchers. The very term the Illuminati is falling into this trap. It's simplifying something, and then, okay, now we've got an easily, conveniently identifiable enemy, and we can now blame everything on them, and it's them and us, them and
right.
us, and it doesn't really... It's a little progress, perhaps, and then calling them reptilians is definitely progress, because then we're getting further and further out of the realms of the actual into the realm of the imaginal. Although, of course, it can go both ways. It's a double-edged sword, this, because if you start dragging the reptilians, if you start insisting that they're literally real and that the Queen and Chris Christopherson are reptilians, then you're dragging the imaginal into the realm of the actual at that point. So, but it seems to me, I mean, if you're creating a bridge, then it's going to be two-way traffic, isn't it?
Right.
And so it's a question of which way the individual goes with that. To me, the idea of reptilians being behind public figures and behind these global conspiracies is I don't want to say accurate, but it's workable, it's a workable hypothesis, because it's taking it further into the realm of the abstract, and once you start talking about reptilians, then you've got to acknowledge that we're talking about things that are not exactly as fixed or as understandable as we would like them to be.
Right.
We definitely have to expand our ideas of what's real and what's not real when we start thinking about in these terms. And the reptilians represent, and perhaps are an aspect of or a reflection of that part of our brain which is reptilian, which is bent purely on survival, self-preservation, predatorial. Again, the instinct for food. This is the kind of energy that is running the universe, or at least at this particular portion of
Right, and when you say reptilian, to me it just means cold-blooded. It's like a sociopath.
That too, yeah, exactly.
You
No,
know?
no conscience, no compassion, no remorse,
Of
pure
course,
ruth.
reptilian in the parapolitical and occult circle, reptilian is going to be largely identified with the reptilian shape-shifting spacemen of David Icke, and that's unfortunate, I think. I don't know if I necessarily subscribe to that. I'm not saying it couldn't be possible. Anything's possible. But it kind of trivializes it. And I don't know if we had talked about this earlier, but it almost seems to reduce it to the absurd.
Well, it do, I mean, it does for most people, but not for me. It doesn't
Right.
make it, it makes it less absurd to me if you're going to talk about, as I say, because it brings it closer to the realm of the imaginal, and therefore it's closer to a myth. So back full circle to your original question, reality and myth are, they overlap. And that myths are blueprints that describe the way in which the psyche interacts with its environment. And the psyche, of course, shapes the environment through interaction with it, and vice versa. The environment shapes the psyche. It's back to the shadow and the, integrating those aspects of ourself through relating with them. So, and myths are, the greatest psychological tools that we have. And I think David Icke is a great myth maker. And whether he takes it as literal reality is another matter. And it doesn't really matter, although I think it interferes with perhaps his presentation, because if he was a better storyteller, there would be a lightness to it, and people could, like Carlos Castaneda's work, people could appreciate them and gain from them without having to make up their mind about whether it's real or not, which is what I attempt with Homo sapiens. You don't have to believe it, because I don't believe it. I don't know. I'm just free associating here with these occult concepts and just seeing where it takes me.
Right.
And that's the way to make new myths, and it's the way to come up with new interpretations of our reality and change our relationship with reality. And I think, reptilians is just an aspect of that, and little grey aliens. These are kind of, they're not new archetypes, but they're new clothes that the archetypes are wearing, or that we've spun together to throw on the archetypes, so they're a little bit less frightening.
So that sounds important, changing our relationship with reality, because as we were talking about earlier, it's kind of that sense of pointlessness that is the biggest enemy to a lot of people, just getting up and not having anything to do worthwhile in the morning. But if you can change your sense of reality, then all of a sudden, that kind of puts a little pep in your stride, gives you something new to do, gives you a fresh outlook on the world.
Yeah, and it's self-sustaining. I mean, it can just keep expanding like a spiral there, because if one's purpose is to change one's sense of reality, and then by changing one's sense of reality one finds new purposes within that, then it just keeps moving. And
That
there's
sounds like the key is constantly changing your sense of reality, keeping it fresh, not getting inundated with one perspective on reality.
Yeah, which of course is diagnosable in our present society as insanity. If we don't have a fixed sense of reality, we are by definition insane, and we can be prescribed medication.
Interesting.
And then it is frightening, but it's better than dying of boredom and despair, that's for sure.
Right. Hey, going back to the reptilians, have you ever read any of Hunter S. Thompson's work?
Yeah, I've read some of that.
And I have too. I was really interested in the artist that he worked with, Ralph Steadman. And I can't remember if it was Ralph or Hunter who talked about them taking LSD and taking heavy doses of LSD for days, and then they would go and sit out in public places and they would see the reptiles walk by.
Well, that's in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, isn't it? They see giant lizards, or Hunter does. Yeah, it's okay. It's even in the movie. Terry Gilliam.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, well, it's atavistic memories, I would say, about that. It's like the reptilian conspiracy and the insectoid greys. They're perfect. They make perfect sense within that context of genetic memory. If we're remembering or tapping into the most recondite and distant part of our DNA, our ancient heritage is as reptilian beings and as insectoid. As I think they're two, they may be two separate streams, but they're both present in our DNA.
Hmm.
And that's why they're so terrifying to us, you see. This is a beautiful irony, is that because the very thing that makes them terrifying is the same thing that makes them so empowering, these archetypes, is because they're the most ancient.
Right. And you know what's interesting? I was just thinking, if you talk about evolution and you talk about the Big Bang, and, you know, in your terms, the Big Bang, when that first point of light comes out of nothing, that would be Lucifer,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
And then even if we subscribe to the occult theory and to like the scientific model, everything creates itself out of nothing, right? You can't get around that.
Well, it comes from nothing. Whether it's self-created is I would say that's impossible to say, isn't it? In Castaneda's model, or Don Juan's model, it's the tonal and the nahal, and the tonal is the world that we know, the world in which the structure and sequence and all the rest of it, and the nahal is the infinite unmanifest from which it emerges. But according to that, the nahalism of the Toltecs, it's only the Nahal that is created, the creative realm, and the realm of the tonal is merely organizational, which brings us back to Jehovah, and that the Demiurge is simply an organizer. He's not a god in the higher sense, because he can't create life. He can merely organize or rearrange the elements that have already been created. So he's an organizer. He's been assigned this role, and then it goes to his head, just as you might say that, you know, that there's a metaphor for the human ego, that we think that we create our reality, and in actual fact, all we're doing is rearranging elements. And Lucifer, I mean, also the myth of Lucifer is similar to that of the Demiurge, who thinks he's God. Well, Lucifer says, you know, I'm the brightest angel and I don't need God. So it's almost the same sort of story, isn't it? And so it's this idea of something that is created, but that then thinks it's self-created.
Right.
But no,
yeah,
all these stories
have very similar themes. You know, when you said the Naha, I immediately thought of the Aboriginal Dreamtime.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know, very similar themes everywhere you go.
Yeah, well, this is the myth behind all myths, isn't it, really? The,
right.
the Naha, the Dreamtime, the unmanifest, where we emerge from, and it's always there. That's the great mystery of the spirit, or the Nahal, is that it's there. It's actually the backdrop to everything. It's like dark matter. It's behind
right.
everything that is, and yet it's not. It is not. It itself is not. It does not exist, and yet nothing else would exist without it.
And that's what I think in the Gnostics had a term.
The Pleroma.
What they'd call also prior acquaintance.
Oh, I was saying the Pleroma was a term that the was used also.
Oh, I haven't heard of that.
I hadn't heard of prior acquaintance either.
Hmm. Interesting.
And they also have the term the forefather, which is the God before God. In the terms of Castaneda again, and these are very key terms for the sorcerer, the Gnostic, you might even say, there's the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. And of course, most of us stay in the realms of the known and don't want to venture anywhere near the unknown. Then some of us do venture into the unknown, and when we do, it's crucial to realize that there is the vast majority of the unknown is actually unknowable to us. And if we confuse the two, then we're lost. Because if you try and investigate the unknowable, it will just swallow you whole. There's no way.
So the unknowable is the abyss, more or less, in a figurative sense.
Well, the abyss is, in the magical sense, of course, is you know, what one has to cross. One has to let go of one's personal self to cross, to attain existence beyond space and time. So I don't know if they are synonymous, to be honest. I guess it's unknowable, so I guess nobody knows. I mean, the abyss, like the unknowable, you can't really talk about it except in negative terms.
Right. So we're talking about the... going back to... Well, let's talk about general sorcery as not like a spooky thing. You know, somebody sitting around in a pentagram with candles burning and enchanting and trying to get a deity to pop up in front of them. When I talk about sorcery, that's not what I'm referring to. For me, sorcery is just more or less a real concerted awareness of your life and its direction it takes, and the fact that you're constantly thinking about changing your sense of reality to steer your life in that direction. Does that make sense?
Yeah, was it Socrates said about an unexamined life is not worth living? One of those Greeks. So yeah, what you've just described would be an examined life. And I think that's a novel definition of sorcery.
Yeah. Well, whenever we were talking earlier and you brought up changing our relationship with reality, that opened up a lot of doors for me. I immediately had a lot of parallels with that. That seemed to me that's what the surrealists were doing.
Mm-hmm.
That was their true goal. I mean, the surrealists weren't simply putting things that didn't belong together on a single canvas for the sake of novelty. The purpose, you know, behind what the surrealists were doing was exactly that. It was changing your relationship with reality by the juxtaposition. The juxtaposition itself wasn't the point of the surrealist games, you know.
But the response,
results.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it was the art that actually interacted with the observer, wasn't it? So the art or the product, if you like, wasn't in the work itself, but in the response that it created in the observer, you might say.
Exactly.
Which I've, in Homo Serpens, I use the phrase a shock of beauty, which, because Breton used the term attack of conscience, which I think is synonymous with what I call a shock of beauty.
Right, and Jacques Vallée in one of his books talks about the confusion technique, you know, where somebody be walking down the street, and I think the example he gives is they'll ask somebody else what time it is, and they'll look at their watch and give them the correct time, and then they'll scream at them and say, "You lie, it's such and such a time," which is totally off, and then run off, and it's supposed to basically just displace their tight hold on that reality at the second.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the theory is that just that slight moment of, and that's almost like assemblage point displacement, isn't it?
That's exactly what it is. You get a wobble of the assemblage point, which is psychologically, I guess they call that cognitive dissonance,
exactly.
Where the sort of the continuity is broken for a moment because there's no, you can't fit what you've just seen into your continuity, into your thought line. You have to make a break. You have to allow a break in it in order just to and this is, you know, why UFO experiences why they're so powerful, and I think why so many people just forget them, if you know, either dismiss them and forget them, or just plain forget them completely, you know, because they can't, if they were to allow them to exist, if they were to hold them in their consciousness for long enough, as the surrealist attempt and as every sorcerer attempts, then it would create cognitive dissonance that would be like a house of cards. One's semblance of sanity comes tumbling down. But that's how we, that's the only way to change our awareness is by pulling the rug out from under our belief system.
Yeah, so there's the paradox again. It seems that we keep coming back to this.
Well, there's a phrase that I think is key here. It's handling awareness as a definition of sorcery. And it creates, to me anyway, it creates an image almost of awareness as a sort of a material. The stuff of dreams that can be shaped if it's handled. But first of all, we have to learn how to handle it. And the very idea that awareness is something is like a medium that can be shaped and experienced. You might even say it was space-time as a single unit. Because scientifically, we've got the idea of space-time. But individually, as personally, we don't know what that means, really. I mean, we can understand theoretically that without space, there's no time, and without time, there's no space, that they're codependent. But, we can travel through space, and by doing so, we are, of course, traveling through time, because it always takes time to travel through space. I think the way to travel through space-time would be when we move through space without it taking any time, for example, such as when we're in dreams, where we can move from one place to another in a moment. And see, in dreams, we're not moving through space, and we're not moving through time. We're moving through awareness, which is why things are so totally different in dreams. Why it's almost impossible for us to even remember our dreams, because it's an experience of reality which is so alien to the one we're used to, which is this three-dimensional A to B experience of space and time,
All right.
And sorcery is when we bring that awareness of dreams into the waking, and we begin to handle awareness as a like a plastic substance that can be shaped, and starting and perhaps ending with ourselves as individual beings.
So it seems that, what we're talking about again, we're talking about having dreams and then beginning to shape your reality based on your dreams. It seems like it's a microcosm of the big process that you're talking about, where Lucifer begins out of nothing, or God becomes Lucifer. It's kind of like he's taken, I don't know, you want to call it a dreamland. I mean, we just talked about dreamland, and then Lucifer comes out of dreamland to shape the material.
Sorcery is a journey of return, that we return from hell carrying trophies of our experience.
Have you ever heard that Picasso and, if I remember correctly, Picasso and Frank Lloyd Wright both, once their lives got to a comfortable place, I believe they both would set about destroying things and making themselves start over from scratch.
Did they know that they were going to destroy the stuff when they did it?
I believe so. I could be wrong, but for some reason that kind of stuck around in my memory. And it sounded like high magic to me whenever I heard both of them. They both seemed to sound like, out of the ashes, sort of rising out of the ashes, or it kind of comes back and it reminds me of that whole problem we have with finding motivation once we get too comfortable. And I'm starting to see this larger system that keeps, it's like a cyclical system to where the creativity gives rise to, our imagination gives rise to creativity, and then the creativity gives rise to action, and then that action turns to activity, and the activity eventually ends up kind of closing in on itself, because just by the nature of the material, it becomes sort of like its own better mousetrap, and then
mm-hmm.
the cycle has to start back over again. It has to be destroyed, or there has to be like a rebirth, or some type of shock, or trauma, or cognitive dissonance, you know, like we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You see that cycle, what I'm talking about? It's like a
I think
larger
so.
Cycle.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I was thinking as you were speaking that it may relate to the personal self getting involved with what we're doing, and so then we eventually, and often very quickly, we turn a creative process into a mundane bid for some sort of mercenary gain, maybe literally, or maybe, you know, more in a more abstract way, that we want prestige or recognition or whatever it is. But once the personal self gets hold of that creative process, then it becomes, I don't want to say debased, because that's a very loaded term, but it becomes limited by that. It can no longer grow and flow. And so it's kind of the tonal, the demiurge again, getting hold of the reins. So the nahal of the true creative energy is becoming trapped by that. And so then those forms that our personal selves impose on the creative current in order to benefit from it, they restrict the flow, and so they have to be destroyed. And so for an artist to willingly destroy those forms, is the higher creativity, as you say, because it's a way of liberating the energy for true creation to occur.
Yeah, and I wasn't talking about like Picasso or Frank Lloyd Wright actually destroying their works, but what they would do is create circumstances in their life to where their lives were actually turned upside down.
Well, yeah, I mean,
as a way of kind of reinvigorating their creative process.
Yeah, well, that's even better then. I misunderstood, but it seems to be the same basic instinct behind it, because you know the creative purpose. It's like the creative life force, creative urge. It's not something that can be rationally directed, I don't think. It has to, it's like any artist will say that they don't have control over the process, you know. When it's really happening, when it's really working, then they surprise themselves. And they're just,
right,
they're just a vehicle or a vessel for something that's coming through them.
Ideally, I think that's the ideal situation, exactly.
Yeah, but you can't, I mean, you can't, that can't coexist, that sort of surrender to the creative process can't coexist with a personal agenda of, you know, what's the world going to think of this? Am I going to be able to pay the rent if this gets published or this gets, you know, exhibited? All of those agendas, they can't, you know, if they're superimposed on the creative process, if they interfere with it, then they're going to do just that. They're going to prevent it from really flowing. And we get trapped again. It's this desire to create these arbitrary goals so that we have the illusion of a sense of purpose, but the result is that we lose our true sense of purpose, which is simply to shape our reality, to handle awareness, to be sorcerers, to be creative, and to dream the dream, and to experience the dream, and really to create. Like anything else, we're witnesses. The joy is in witnessing what we create, not in making sure it comes out exactly the way we intended it to, much less that it's received the way we would like. All of that stuff is a side effect. If we're lucky, it will coincide with what we would like personally. But at an impersonal level, where true creation takes place, we could care less about these things. Essentially, I mean, the artistic and the creative urge is, as I've said, is the totally opposed to whatever it takes to get established in the world. And yet,
right,
we look at Van Gogh, I mean, how dispiriting and frustrating it can be if you can't even eat. Because an artist, somebody who's driven to be creative and to express ideas, often they don't have any choice, speaking from experience, then they may not even be able to eat if they're not careful.
Right.
Because they'll just get so carried away, they can't hold down a job. They don't even want to have a job, but they're willing to sacrifice everything just to, there's ego involved as well, of course. But nonetheless, they may be creating great works of art and nobody notices, nobody cares until after they're dead. And that's the problem. That's the world that we live in. And
It's all about marketing. It's all about marketing and networking. You know what I
well,
mean?
yeah, I guess. I mean, that's what I'm saying. And but it's also an attitude, isn't it? It's a way of perceiving one's products, one's currency. Again, a way of handling awareness. It's not just
Yeah.
what you do, but how you do it. I mean, somebody else could have been successful with my stuff, not necessarily by networking more or working harder, but just by doing it in a different way, that have had a different attitude and a different mood, and it would have they would have gone around the obstacles instead of going straight into them, which is what I've done. I've just kept banging my head up against the gates that the gatekeepers won't open for me. And so I've got exhausted. I got to the point where I just think, fuck it. I won't stop creating. I won't stop writing books. But I'm going to stop trying to get noticed because it's too dispiriting for me. Too much energy
Yeah,
is going.
I was thinking that's why I got lost while you were talking, because I was thinking about that exact thing earlier today, and I was thinking, we're really what it's doing is it's just killing my love for art. I mean, I just, I can just get up in the morning and just lose myself. Like you say, I can just channel and just basically almost disappear, except for my arms holding the brushes or whatever, moving in front of my face. And I just totally become, an instrument of the universe, sort of. That sounds hokey, but that's okay.
No, it doesn't sound hokey, and it sounds to me that you're really, really lucky that you can have that, and so much luckier, Carrie, than somebody who's, successful, Jackson Pollock or whoever, biggest artists in the world. If they don't have what you've just described, then they've got nothing. And if you had to choose, which would you rather? If you had to give up what you've just described and you could be successful, would you do it?
No, and that's why, that brings us to what I was thinking. I was thinking, I just need to separate the two. I need to separate my creative self from the guy who has to live in the real world, and the guy who has to live in the real world needs to try to find a way to make money, and not through art, because what it's doing is it's debasing the art process,
Interesting, because I had the same thought today that I'm just ready to get a job, planting trees or just the most, menial labor is what I would go for. I couldn't do office work or anything like that, but just to be a working man, a working stiff even at this point, it's humility demands it really,
Yeah.
because you can't be true to your muse and expect to get paid for it.
Yeah.
You
That's
can't.
true.
You might get paid if you're really lucky, but you certainly can't
Right.
expect it.
Well, that's the thing too. I don't think that getting paid for it would diminish it at all. But the thing that diminishes it, in my opinion, is having to put yourself out there and become a used car salesman type personality in order to move the product. That's what diminishes it. It's not the act of getting paid for it doesn't diminish the creative process.
No, but
What do
it might, and what you're saying diminishes it, needn't diminish it either, because if you didn't feel that way, if you didn't create that sort of dichotomy in your mind that, and if you saw going out there being a used car salesman, if you saw it instead as going out there and being a sorcerer and handling awareness and shaping your reality, you would just be playing a role, and you could enjoy the role precisely because you knew how totally unlike you it was. And it would there would be great power in creating an impression that was totally false. But the only way you could actually succeed, and it's almost impossible, I certainly haven't been able to do it, was if you were doing it as pure sorcery for the joy of it, not in order to sell your car, you know?
That's very interesting, yeah. Very interesting.
So, I mean, we almost have to trick ourselves at that point. It's like when you want to give something up, the only way you can really give it up is by not wanting it. And so the harder you try to give it up, the more you want it. It doesn't work. So you've got to just let yourself have it. So the thing with trying to be successful, the only way we can actually, I think, you or I, as sorcerers, you know, fledgling sorcerers, the only way we'll ever be successful, because we can't carry on trying, is by not wanting to. And then going out there and doing it because we don't want to, just because it's the last thing we want, maybe. Yeah. So in the meantime, yeah, it does seem like we just have to earn a crust through the perhaps the most mundane way, and maybe that's what the universe is telling us, that we need to be a little more, what's the word, prosaic, you know, humble. I mean, there are, I don't know about where you are, and certainly not where I am right now, but where I hope to be soon, that there's kinds of work that one can do that aren't demeaning. I mean, sweeping the street is a good example. Many of the jobs that we consider, you know, as, in terms of social status, are demeaning, are actually the least demeaning. Trash collection, that would be something I'd do, I don't know about happily, but at least I'd feel good about doing it. As opposed to working in an office or a bank and getting paid maybe 3 times as much, I couldn't do that because it would sap my energy. But if I was out on the street actually clearing up humans' trash, at least I'd feel I had a relationship with the earth, you know.
Yeah.
And with my environment. So I would imagine, for me anyway, I would imagine that something quite menial is what I'll end up with at this stage. It's... if necessary, you know. Hopefully now that I've said this, the universe will say, ah, he's learned his lesson now.
But it's not even, you know, whether it's menial or not doesn't really bother me. It's just the time.
Time consumption, I know. But,
consumption.
You know, how much of our time do we spend thinking anyway? Just thinking, and that's, we could do that if we were working certain jobs, the kind of job that I would like. Or would accept gardening, for example.
Yeah. I don't know what you mean exactly by thinking. I mean, were you talking about like just sitting around, you know, in a chair meditating, sort of thinking?
No, I mean just thinking. I mean, okay, maybe you're ostensibly busy cooking food or going to the shops or what have you, but a lot of your energy, and remember, time is energy, or energy is time, rather. You know, for a sorcerer, as I pointed out, there's no time separate from space. Time isn't the currency, it's energy. And so if we use energy thinking, even though we might only be going 5 minutes down to the shop, the amount of useless thinking we're doing, we're actually losing a lot more than just 5 minutes, because we're losing all of that energy that's going into it. You know, and that's it's a hard thing to grasp if one's locked into the mundane. But in actual, for a sorcerer, there is no time in the usual sense, and what there is measured in seconds, not in months or weeks. It's, you know, every second is a window of awareness for a sorcerer, and then, you know, one's whole reality can change in a split second. And so, yeah, I mean, we can create time. Sorcerers do create time, and humans don't. But of course, ordinary humans, we're all sorcerers potentially. We've all got that unconscious reservoir of power, which is sorcery. And so we're performing sorcery unconsciously, which is what black magic is, essentially. And so humans are doing the inverse. They're constantly destroying time. They're constantly killing time. Even when they're doing stuff that they think they have to do, working the job, you know, that's, of course, a way of killing time, too.
Yeah.
So the time can be created as well as killed, and it's I mean, you must have had days where you just felt that day was full to the brim, and not because you did all this stuff, probably on the contrary, but just because you were tuned in to what you were doing. And so, So you feel like your soul or your energy has somehow been boosted by that day, by the activity of the day. And so
Right, and that has just a lot to do with your mood of the day.
yeah, it absolutely does, but it's a kind of chicken or an egg thing, because your mood shapes your action, and then your actions shape your mood. So which comes
Right.
first? I don't know. I really no longer know what it is that makes a bad day and a good day. You know, waking up feeling shit doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to have a shit day.
Right.
My moods can change from one hour to the next, and I don't just mean a little bit. I mean they can go from the extreme of despair to the extreme. No, unfortunately, I don't have the opposite extreme to despair very often, but at least to well-being. And for no ostensible reason, well, maybe I played guitar for 10 minutes, and that was all it took. You know? And yet, why? If that's the case, why wouldn't I just pick up the guitar every time I'm in despair? Because I don't.
What do I need to start doing? You know, I'm starting to think of maybe I need to start doing more actual kind of surrealist sorcery exercises in my own life, sort of.
Well, you know, the best sorcery exercise, in my opinion, I mean, the most effective one, is one that's called not doing. And it kind of relates to what we were saying earlier about the art of the creative cycles. Because not doing entails acting for no reason, for no reason whatsoever. Doing something that one has got no reason to do, and that there's nothing to gain by doing it, and therefore, and this creates a cognitive dissonance, because one can't have any feelings about it or even think about it, because it's just so irrational.
All right.
And that frees up this energy, because because we can't we don't feel the sense of the mundane purpose. We create a cognitive dissonance in our sense of purpose. We don't know why we're doing it, except that it's sorcery. It creates that space for this deeper purpose, which is the spirit, which is intent. Then it moves in, and that's very liberating. That's why I think painting or playing the guitar, any sort of right brain activity, I mean, in a sense, there isn't a purpose to that either. It's closer to a not doing, isn't it? Because I pick up the guitar, I'm not necessarily practicing. I'm just making noise. I'm not definitely not composing. I'm just doing something with my body in order to not do all the other stuff that I do to try and keep the terrible abyss of my life at bay, you know.
Right.
And I imagine that you get sucked into art in a similar way, even though it's a doing as well, because you're creating a product. But
Yeah, but I mean, I will sit down at the table to do a drawing, and then 4 hours later, after I finish or something, you know, I'll look at it, and I'll be like, where did that come from?
okay, that's all we have for this week. Any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact me at my blog. It's aeoluskephas.blogspot.com. And for all you out there interested in some very surrealist artwork, check out Kerry's website, kerrymccoy.com. We have a little extra time this week, so I'm going to leave you with Steve Harley and the Cockney Rebel. The song is called Ritz. That's all for now. I wish you all the bliss you can handle.
patience covered kisses, glazed calico cloth, my costume this is. Come to Pablo Funk, he's an indigo, and we'll show you past the shades of rye. It's okay to laugh in harmony, see the white-faced August's army. Come to Pablo Funk, he's an indigo, we'll show you past the shades of rye. Shall we put together a platoon? I don't wanna be that soon.